All right, here's our outline of Genesis. We're winding up Genesis tonight. We are obviously in the last section of that, where we are dealing with the patriarchal period, patriarchal history. We have the chosen family and then their descent into Egypt. And that's where we leave them. As we leave the book, we see God building a nation and God preserving a nation, and we'll see statements about God preserving that nation in chapter 50. Now, I'm not going to go through the chapter titles, but I want to just make a brief comment. As we go through any book, whether it's a book of Matthew, or we're about to begin Mark, or we're going to begin Exodus, here Genesis, the value of that, of us rehearsing that as much as we can't do all of that, is that the more we go over those chapter titles, hopefully that ingrains a little bit in our minds, so that in a Bible class or a sermon, you hear someone mention, for example, Genesis chapter 4, you remember that's the case with Cain and Abel. Or you hear someone mention Genesis chapter 17, oh, that's the where circumcision was given as a sign, before you get turned there, that you begin to think of those concepts, and that'll help you in your reflection on the text. All right, well, let's look at chapter 48 now. Before we do that, I want to remind you one more time of watching for God's evidence or evidence of God's providence. And we flag these three verses, one of which we'll study tonight in chapter 50 and in verse 20. And mark that as a providence passage where God is using the free will of man, even sometimes sinful actions of men, to accomplish his purpose to preserve a nation through whom the Messiah will come. So if you haven't already, chapter 50 and verse 20 would be one of those verses you want to flag. All right, here's chapter 48. We're going to try to work our way through, and hopefully we'll have time for a question or two at the end that I want to ask. And I like to ask at the end of each book, so we'll see if we get that far. In chapter 48, we have Jacob blesses Joseph's son. Some time has passed now, and so we have beginning in chapter 48, Jacob is going to call Joseph's sons to him, or Joseph brings his sons to Jacob, and Jacob blesses them. Four things we're going to notice, and we'll start with the fact that Manasseh and Ephraim are elevated to the status of sons. And then we'll get to the other points. Now, verse 1 and 2, Joseph brought his sons to Jacob because he was sick. And so it was said to Joseph, your father is sick. And so he took his two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. They would be in their early 20s at this point. You say, how do you know that? Because the text did not tell us that here. But they were born before the famine. And so they would have had to been about 5 to 6 years old. That's not an exact age. We're just giving round numbers. Somewhere around the 5 to 6 or 5 and 6 years old by the time that Jacob came into Egypt. And then Jacob is there for 17 years, as we saw in chapter 47 and in verse 28. So that would put them in their early 20s. So they're in their early 20s is the general time frame. I'm not really worried about whether they were 23 or 25. They're in the early 20s, somewhere in that age bracket as they come before their grandfather Jacob. And so that's in verses 1 and 2, and he strengthened himself, that is Jacob strengthened himself and sat up on the bed. Now verses 3 and 4, Jacob tells Joseph of God's promise. And he talks about when he was in the land God appeared to him at Luz in the land of Canaan and blessed him. What's he talking about? Or what occasion is he talking about? Luz is another term for Bethel. Talking about Genesis 28. So that occasion, you remember where he stopped at Bethel and he sees the ladder in his vision. God makes a promise to him. That's what he's talking about. So you might make a note, Genesis 28, that's at Bethel. And here's what God said. What is the promise that was made at verse 4 here? That he said, that was made back to me over at Bethel. And reminds Joseph of this. He's going to be fruitful and multiply you and make you a multitude of people and give this land to your descendants. So we're going to see more about the seed promise and the Messiah later, but the land promise and the nation promise is really what's being rehearsed here. So of those three promises of Genesis 12, he goes over two of those. God had reminded me and God told me over at Bethel concerning the promise, going to make a great nation out of my descendants and you're going to go back to this land. You're going to inherit this land. So that's basically that. Now, verses 5 and 6, Jacob treats Joseph's sons as his own. In other words, he elevates them to the status of sons. So he said, and now your two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, who were born to you, are mine. I don't mean they're literally his sons, but I'm treating them and elevating them to the status of sons. We'll see more about that a little bit later. Just as Reuben and Simeon, they are mine, and his other offspring, though, are going to be treated as grandchildren. Make sense? That is other offspring from Joseph. So any other descendants other than these two will be like grandchildren. But these are elevated as sons. Making sense? You'll see more significance of that as we get into the promises. Now, beginning at verse 7, this is quite interesting. It seems like a diversion to another subject, but there's a recalling and a remembrance of Rachel, Joseph's mother. Now, what's interesting, the Good News Bible, and I recognize the Good News Bible is quite free and eclectic. It's not a wooden translation at all. It is very fluid and free and eclectic. And so it's more of a paraphrase, but I like this wording of this at verse 7 when he says, "But as for me, when I came to Paddan, Rachel died." The Good News Bible words that, "I'm doing this because of your mother." In other words, I'm taking these sons of yours and elevating them to the status of sons, and I'm doing that because, Joseph, your mother, Rachel. Now, is that the point? Well, it seems to have some connection in the context. Otherwise, why mention in this context, "Oh, by the way, your mother died and we buried her on the way." And it seems to have some connection with blessing Joseph's sons. Make sense? Well, if you agree with that, then you might flag the Good News Bible as kind of a commentary on that. All right, now verse 8 beginning. So Joseph's sons, Manasseh and Ephraim, are elevated to the status of sons. We're going to see that in the settlement in the land a little bit later. Jacob then blesses the sons of Joseph. And so beginning at verse 8 through 11, Jacob is delighted. He makes the point here. What's he say here about something in contrast? We're looking at 8 through 11. We're not ready for what he does with his right hand yet. Verse 12. Yeah, I didn't think I'd see you again alive, but now not only have I seen you, I got to see your sons. I got to see Manasseh and Ephraim. And so he says here at beginning at verse 8, "Who are these?" It's not that he didn't know who they were. One commentator compared that to a wedding where who gives this bride? Well, we all know who gives the bride before the question is asked. It's a formality. So who are these? His eyes are dim, but it's more of a formality. Who are these? "Well, these are my sons that God has given me in this place." Well, and so he's glad to see them. Now, beginning at verse 12, let's get to this thought, because this gets to the key of what's going to happen in even into the next chapter. "Joseph brought them beside his knees, and he bowed down to the face of the earth, and Joseph took both of them, Ephraim in his right hand, and Manasseh," which is the eldest son, "in his left hand." And so get the picture of Joseph sitting on the side of the bed. And here, Jacob sitting on the side of the bed, Joseph come facing him, and he's got one son on the right side and one son on the left side, and the one that's on the left side would be to Jacob's right hand. And that's Manasseh, the eldest. That was staged, that was on purpose, because the right hand generally is the hand where the blessing is given, and so this is the son that is to receive the greatest blessing. He is the eldest son. That's what Joseph is thinking. What happens at verse 14? Yeah. He crossed them so that his left hand is on Manasseh and his right hand is on Ephraim. And he started giving a blessing upon them. Now let's pause just for a moment. Was he confused? Absolutely not. Let's get ahead of ourselves to verse 19. Later when Joseph goes to correct him, I know, I know. Jacob is being divinely guided, I'm convinced. That he is being, one writer, and I forgot the writer that was quoted, said, what he lacked in visual and physical, this is not a direct quote, what he lacked in physical vision, he made up in divine vision, meaning that God enabled him to see. He could see the future through the revelation of God. And so I think he's being divinely guided. It's not a mistaken man who doesn't know how to pronounce a blessing and got his hands mixed up or got the sons mixed up. In fact, he said, I know. He meant to do this. And he seems to be divinely guided in so doing. But be that as it may, here's the blessing. As he blessed him, he said, God, and much of what he has to say is a pronouncement of the greatness of God. God, before whom my father Abraham, Isaac, and Isaac walked, God who fed me all along the way, God who redeemed me. Now we get to the end of verse 16. Bless the lads, let my name be named upon them, and the name of my father Abraham and Isaac, and let them grow into a multitude in the midst of the earth. Well, it's the latter part of that that's quite interesting. Now, all the praises of what God has done is fascinating. But may they grow, what's the phrase here, into a multitude in the midst of the earth. Willis suggests in his work that the word grow is used as a swarm of fish in the sea. In other words, may they multiply innumerable. Does that make sense? So may these sons grow and become innumerable. Now he's going to say more about that, and we're going to flag some passages in Numbers 1 and Numbers 26 in a moment about these two, the descendants of these two sons. But that's all he says at that moment. Now what does Joseph do? Now that gets us through verse 16. Joseph, he tried to move the hands. He saw that the hand was on the wrong son. In his mind, it was on the wrong son. And it displeased him, and he took hold and removed him. And this is where his father, he said, now this is my firstborn. And the father refused, saying, I know, my son, I know. I take that to mean, I know what I'm doing. I think that suggests that he's divinely guided in so doing. He's not mistaken. Now then, let's get to verse 19. We get a little more interesting here. Jacob refused, and he set Ephraim before Manasseh, the younger before the elder. Let's get that. Look at verse 19. He said, I know my son, he also shall become a great people, and he shall be great, but truly his younger brother shall be greater than he, and the descendant shall be a multitude of nations. Now, does that refer to the number? Well, at first, that's true. We'll get to that more in a moment. But I might just flag Numbers 21 suggests that Ephraim's tribe had, at the first numbering, had 40,500, and Manasseh's tribe had 32,200. So Ephraim was larger. Now, they reversed that number later in Numbers 26. So I don't think it's limited to numbers as much as it does that Ephraim became far more influential, became the predominant tribe of the northern 10 tribes. Make sense? Not so with Manasseh. So there was this blessing. Now we'll say more about that as we go on. Let's get verse 20. So he blessed them and he said, by you Israel I will bless, by you Israel will bless, saying, may God make you as Ephraim and as Manasseh. And thus he set Ephraim before Manasseh. Now let's get verses 21 and 22. So he attempted to correct and that didn't work. Now Jacob makes two promises to Joseph. What's the first? Verse 21. This is part of what makes me understand this discussion. Jacob is divinely guided. It's not just Jacob is making a prediction. Here's kind of what I feel like, or what I hope y'all do. He is divinely guided. Evidence of that comes more in chapter 49. What's he saying, 21? Yeah. God's going to be with you. I'm dying, and God will be with you and bring you back to the land of your fathers. Several things we learned from that. There's trust in the promises of God, and so you act accordingly. There's the dependence on God, the recognizing he's going to die, and what he needs to do before he dies. All right, verse 22. The second promise. is that I'll bless you with double portion. I have given you one portion above your brothers. Now that generally was held for the eldest son. That wasn't Joseph. That was Reuben. Reuben's not going to get it. Evidence, chapter 49. So what's verse 42 saying? Ephraim became that leading tribe of the northern 10 tribes. So much so that sometimes the northern kingdom of Israel was referred to as Ephraim, wasn't it? So some references to Ephraim had reference to the northern 10 tribes, the whole bunch of them. Make sense? The predominant tribe. So the statement is true. Manasseh had land on both sides of the river. No other tribe had that. And furthermore, the two tribes together were larger than any other tribe. So you look at the numbers, and I'm not going to take the time to do that, but go to Numbers 1. And in that first census that was given, I've already given the numbers of 42,500 and 32,500, that's Ephraim and Manasseh, came to 72,700. There was not any other tribe came to that number. And so Joseph's descendants together were larger than any others. And so this again is not prediction, this is divine prophecy. Make sense? All right, chapter 48. Jacob blesses Joseph's sons. There's a special blessing upon these sons. So when we get to the settlement of the land and we have half a tribe of Manasseh here and half a tribe there, and then this predominant tribe later of Ephraim, we're going to remember back. I remember Jacob blessing these sons, and that's going to be important. All right, chapter 49. Only two things happen, but there's a lot happens in these 2 points. Jacob's last message to his sons. And so Jacob blesses, gives blessings, and he talks about the future on his sons, and then Jacob makes a request for burial and for his death. So let's talk about the sons. This again is prophetic. I take it that when Jacob called his sons, let's get verses 1 and 2 before we get into the list of the sons. Jacob called his sons and he said, "Gather me and I'll tell you what shall befall you in the last days." Again, this is not wishful thinking. Let me tell you what I wished y'all would do. Or I hope y'all do, or this is my prediction, then this I take to be divine revelation, God speaking through Jacob. Now, gather and listen to Israel your father. So he starts with the first. So here's Reuben. Now I want you to notice in the first three, and I got an asterisk beside Judah, because Judah receives the blessing that would come to the eldest son. And so he passes over Reuben, Simeon, and Levi for the firstborn blessing and comes down to make Judah the predominant tribe. Does that make sense? And he tells us why. So what does he say about Reuben? He said, "You're my firstborn, my eldest son." Says he's unstable. "You were my strength from the beginning, and you were the excellency of power, but you're unstable as water, and you shall not excel." That's prophecy. That's not my prediction, that's prophecy. Now, why did he say that? Slept with his father's concubine. So if you don't have a marginal note to the side, you might have it in the center reference column. Genesis 35, 22. That seemed to where he seemed to be seizing a leadership that was quite often done. You would sleep with a king's son, sometime would sleep with his dad's concubines to suggest that he's seizing power. And it seemed to be a power, political move. But nonetheless, he slept with his father's concubine. "You defiled it and you went up to my couch. Because of that, you're not going to excel." Well, he didn't. All right, now let's talk about Simeon and Levi. What did he say about them? Instruments of cruelty. What's he referring to? Yeah, when Dinah was defiled, and they went in and slaughtered the whole city of Shechem. Remember that? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, they are cruel. Genesis 34, if you don't have marginal notes that the translators have provided, that's Genesis 34 in the case of Dinah. For in their anger they slew a man, in their self-will they hamstrung an ox. Cursed be their anger, for it is fierce. And then here's the pronouncement and the curse upon them. In other words, for being cruel, I will divide them in Jacob and I will scatter them in Israel. What does that refer to? They are not going to get an inheritance themselves. Now let's take Levi, for example. They're going to be scattered because it's from Levi comes the priestly tribe. And so they don't have land allotted to them, but they are going to settle among the other tribes. We all know that. Simeon has his inheritance within the tribe of Judah. And so as we have the tribes divided up, you don't have this over here for Simeon and Levi. In other words, I'm going to scatter. They were cruel, they were inhumane, and I'm going to scatter them. That's part of their curse for what they did. So here are the first three in their order of birth, skipped over for receiving the power and the birthright of the eldest son. And so now he comes to Judah. And this is where it gets interesting now. He said, "You are he whom your brothers shall praise." That's basically the meaning of the name Judah. He shall be praised. And so some writers play on the word, and perhaps there is the play on words. Judah, you are who you are. You are to be praised and praised by your brothers. Now he compares Judah, "Your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies," showing the power, the dominance that this tribe would have. But Judah is a lion's whelp. A lion's whelp is a young lion. He says three things about the young lion now. So let's talk about the three things he says about the young lion. It's a young lion, basically, it's a description when we get through with the three things. Growing up, this young lion grows up and becomes strong and becomes powerful and to be feared. Not Reuben, not Simeon, not Levi, but Judah. Making sense? Being skipped over, this is where it lands, right here with Judah. Now notice the three things he says about the lion's whelp. "From prey, my son, you have gone up. He bows down and lies down as a lion, who shall arouse him?" That is, he escapes from the power of the prey. He takes prey. That is, he takes captive of his prey, as the young lion would do. And then he comes and lies down, meaning he's captured his prey. And then he's lying there resting. And then the question is raised, who shall arouse him? In other words, all standing, who's going to go mess with that lion? Because they're fearful of him. So it's descriptive, however you look at those three things that he just listed about the young lion, it's descriptive of a young lion growing up and becoming powerful. Make sense? Strength, strong, powerful. That's what you're going to be. Now then, the next thing he says at verse 10, "The scepter shall not depart from Judah." What's that referring to? It ultimately comes to the coming of Christ, mentioned in the next phrase. But the scepter, I think, is the Davidic line, the line of David. That is, that's going to be through Judah. And the scepter shall not depart from Judah. Making sense? That's where the David's line and the lineage is going to be through which the Messiah is going to come. Keep your eye on that scepter. Here is the king, the ruler. Keep your eye on the scepter now. Don't forget that at verse 10. "Nor a lawgiver from between his feet." So the scepter is not going to depart. And as a king would sit with his scepter in his hand, he rests it between his feet. That's the idea of he's a lawgiver. He's rules with power and authority until Shiloh comes. Now that's the big question. Obviously that refers to the Messiah. But explore all the possibilities of that, and you'll have 7 or 8 different explanations of that. That does not refer to Shiloh the city, but it probably refers to one to whom the scepter belongs. It has reference to the Messiah. So you might make a marginal note that that is a messianic prophecy. Now, how can I interpret that passage? Well, let's go to Ezekiel chapter 21 and verse 27. I think most think that this Ezekiel 21 and 27 is a quotation from our passage in Genesis. Speaking of Shiloh. So verse 27 says, overthrown, overthrown, I will make it overthrown. It shall be no longer until he comes whose right it is. And I will give it to him whose right it is. Now you may think that's not a quotation from Genesis 48 or 49 and in verse 10. Most think that it probably is. If it is, and I'm going to assume that it is, it serves then as a commentary on what this is talking about, which makes sense in the context. I said don't lose sight of the scepter. And I'm going to paraphrase, that the scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor that power of being a lawgiver from between his feet, until the Messiah comes to whom it belongs. Does that make sense? That seems to be how it's used over in Ezekiel. So Ezekiel 21, 27 seems to serve as a commentary on this, that the scepter belongs to the hand of Shiloh, the Messiah, when he comes. Make sense? It's not going to depart till it comes into the hand of the one to whom it belongs. Who does it belong to? The Messiah. Now, that makes sense because of the next phrase, and to him shall be the obedience of the people. People are going to obey and submit to him. Coming out of Judah. So the Messiah is coming out of the tribe of Judah. We're seeing that in prophecy. That's what we're wanting to see. Now 11 and 12, I think, and I'm not going to get into details on that, but I think 11 and 12 talks about the prosperity of that tribe. So he says a great deal about Judah, camps on Judah. And it makes you wonder if Zebulun's sitting here thinking, well, what's he going to say about me? And doesn't say much about Zebulun. Or Issachar. Or many of the rest of them, but he says a great deal about Judah. It's out of the tribe of Judah the Messiah is coming. That's what the book's all about. Is that making sense? To me, that makes more sense than some of the other explanations, and I don't have time to go into them. Check Willis if you want to buy the two-volume set and explore all of those 7 or 8 different explanations. All right, let's talk about Zebulun. What did he say about Zebulun? You are going to have... Yeah, that's basically it. You're going to have a haven by the sea and the shore by the sea, and ships will come to you. That's it. So nothing about a Messiah coming out of you, but that's their future. That was true. Issachar is a strong donkey lying down between burdens. And he saw that rest was good. In other words, gave up, like a donkey carrying a load and then gave up on carrying the load. Well, what's he talking about? Well, he bowed his shoulder to the burden and became a band of slaves. They were unable to drive the Canaanites out, and they'd rather compromise than fight. So they were like a donkey that gave up carrying the load. They sat down on the load. And if you can imagine your work donkey carrying all your burden and he just lays down, he didn't do his job. And they didn't do their job either. Now, what does it say about Dan? Dan is compared to a serpent, giving the idea perhaps of deceit. Gad is said, you shall do what? Gad would be trampled, but ultimately be triumphant. Then he says Asher, going to be rich. There's prosperity with Asher. Naphtali, basically all that's said about Naphtali is it's like a deer let loose. He gives goodly words, graceful words. Some suggest that, and I'm not convinced that that's all there, but that it is suggesting he's going to be a graceful warrior. But he gives goodly words. Now, let's turn to Joseph now, because more attention is given to Joseph than any other, with the exception of Judah. What does he say about Joseph? All right. Like a fruitful bough that here's the plant that grows, and it grows and it grows and goes over the wall, and that's the way Joseph is going to be. And so what he says is that despite his brother's efforts to destroy him, he ultimately became and will become strong. Evidence of that is when they settle in the land later. We're ways from that, but when they settle in the land, you're going to have a tribe of Ephraim and a half a tribe and another half a tribe of Manasseh, all reminders of the greatness of Joseph. And then here's going to be Issachar, and here's going to be these other little tribes over here. Make sense? And so Joseph, who they tried to destroy, is going to have predominance in the land when he comes in. Now, he's not going to live to see it. He's going to die tonight in our story. But his children and his grandchildren, his tribes, will be there. All right. Now then, let's get Benjamin. What does he say about Benjamin? All right. Yeah, he's going to conquer. He's going to be like a ravenous wolf. He's going to conquer. And then verse 20 said, all these are the 12 tribes of Israel. What their father spoke to them, and he blessed them, and he blessed each of them according to his own blessing. So each one got his own blessing. All right. Now we're going to see fulfillment of that. There'll be times as we go through history that we're not going to take the time tonight. We'll come up on something about a tribe, and we'll say that fits with the promise and the prophecy of Jacob. Does that make sense? So we'll be reminded of that. All right, now let's talk about Jacob's request for burial and his death. He said he was going to be gathered to his people, and now what's his request? I want you to take me back to Canaan and bury me in Canaan. And so keep in mind where they are. They're over here in Goshen. That's the shaded area at Ramses, and they're going to make their way back up here to near Hebron, to the cave of Machpelah, right here close to Mamre and Hebron. So we've seen this before. Machpelah is right here in close proximity to Mamre and to Hebron. This is the Salt Sea or the Dead Sea over here. And there is a structure there today. We saw that back at Genesis 23 that we think perhaps is the burial place that's being referred to, though we don't know that for sure. But here's an aerial view of the cave of Machpelah today. And the idea is that he's carrying me back. Now, that's not what it looked like then, but the point is it's that region where they were carrying him, their father. Let's go on to that. We're nearly done with chapter 49. But what's interesting is this is where Abraham and Sarah and Isaac and Rebekah, and that's where I buried Leah. Now, he mentioned that he buried Rachel along the way, but he's buried with Leah. Not with Rachel that he loved the most. Jacob loved Rachel more than Leah. And Leah saw that she was hated. She was not loved as well. But he's going to be buried with Leah, not with Rachel. That's interesting. One writer said that Leah gets what in death what she always wanted in life, to be with Jacob. Interesting. So verse 33, Jacob had finished these, and he drew his feet up in the bed and drew his last breath and was gathered to his people, which is a statement concerning his death. All right. Let's make our way through chapter 50 now, and we'll be done. Chapter 50, Joseph buries Jacob, and he comforts his brother, and he dies. So he takes his father's body back to Egypt, that journey we just talked about. We talked in previous studies, could take up to 2 weeks or longer to get there, 3 weeks maybe, to make that journey. And so Jacob fell on his father's face, and he kissed him, and he called for the physicians to come, and they embalmed Israel. The only two people in the Bible that are said to be embalmed are Jacob and Joseph. Now, were others? Maybe. But they're only two that's mentioned as being embalmed. That was a practice that was common among the Egyptians. There were various ways of doing that. And so depending on the point of development, that some stage of embalming took up to 40 days, which this one seemed to, because they took 40 days to embalm them. It doesn't take 40 days in our method of embalming today. And so some think, Willis seems to argue this, that probably this had to do with mummification and the full form of full-fledged mummification as the Egyptians practice. And probably that was at this point where Joseph's story fits in. I'll leave that for you to decide. But whatever they did in the embalming, there was a 40-day process of that. Then upon the 40 days, they took an additional 30 days for mourning. So a total of 70 days for mourning in Egypt before they ever leave. Make sense? All right. Now then, Joseph goes and asks permission of the king. What? My father made me swear and promise I'd go back, take him back, and I want to go back. And so he tells him to go. So who all goes? All of them, except they left the young and all of their flocks behind with the promise of coming. And apparently some other Egyptians went along. Maybe evidence of that a little later in the context. We'll get to that perhaps in a moment. Then they came to the floor of Atad, which is also referred to Abel Mizraim at verse 11. And it says it's on the other side of Jordan. Well, we don't know where that is. It is not likely that they go from here to the other side of the Jordan and then came around from over the Jordan River. Usually that phrase on the other side means on the east side of the Jordan. But that phrase can also mean in the area of Jordan, which means it could have been on the west side. No one knows the location. I haven't found anybody that says, any reference of anybody that says, I think I know this is the location of this. But wherever this was in the region of the Jordan, they came there and they stopped. And what'd they do? For 7 more days. So they've already had 70 days and 7 more days. And the Canaanites, what was their impression of that? Yeah, they've not seen anything like this, apparently, that what the Egyptians were doing. This is grievous mourning of the Egyptians. And so they called it Abel Mizraim, which is beyond the Jordan. And so his son did for him just as he commanded. They carried him and they put him in the cave. Now, beginning at verse 15 now, let's go back to verse 15 through 21. Joseph's brothers now begin to think, vengeance is coming. Maybe their reasoning is the only reason he treated us the way that he did and with kindness is because daddy was still living. Daddy's gone and dead. Daddy's not in the way anymore, and he may take vengeance on us. So they sent a message to him, and what is their message? Verse 17. Yeah, Daddy talked to us about this and told us to come to you and send message to you and beg for forgiveness. Now please forgive the trespass of your servants. And Joseph wept when they spoke to him. And he fell on his face and they said, behold, we are your servants. I can't help but think when I read that statement, them laughing about the fact he had said, you'll bow down before me. And they thought that was funny. They thought that was ridiculous. And now they're willingly, they want to bow down before him. We don't want death. We want to be your servants. Now flag verse 20, providence passage. What do you see at verse 20? Yeah. Did they do evil? You bet. Was it sinful? Absolutely. But God can take that and use it for good. Doesn't mean God caused it. But he said, you meant it for evil, but God meant it for good in order to bring it about this day to save many people alive. God preserving a nation through whom the Messiah is going to come. That's what the latter 37, chapter 37 through 50, that's the point. God preserving a nation through whom the Messiah is going to come. And so if you say, oh, how do I summarize chapter 37 to 50? Look at verse 20 in our text. So don't be afraid. I'll provide for you and for your children. And then, 20 to 26, Joseph dies. How old was he? He's 110, and he made a request like his father did. He wants his bones to go into the land of Canaan. You might, if you don't have a marginal note, at verse 24, Exodus 3:19, remember Moses carries his bones into Egypt, I mean into Canaan. Remember that? Exodus 3:19. And so here's the case of them, of God again, preserving a nation. I'll bring you out of this land, bring you in. But I want to go back to verse 23 before we get through. Joseph saw Ephraim's children to the third generation. I take that to mean that he was able to see, here is Joseph, and here is Manasseh. It would have been one of Manasseh's sons, that he was able to see these sons here. That he lived not only to see his grandchildren, but great-grandchildren. So he lived to be 110, he got to see great-grandchildren. Here's the boy that was thrown in the pit, thought he was going to die, didn't think he'd live to see another day, and he lived to be 110, a great leader out of Egypt, preserving his own people, and he lived to see his great-grandchildren. Now then, that's the end of Genesis. We see God built a nation, and God preserved a nation. Now, we've got a minute or two. I always like to ask this question at the end of a study of a book. And this may vary, and it would. My answer to this question varies from time to time that I study it. What has impressed you most in this study of Genesis? What stood out most in your mind? Because I've got a different answer this time, maybe, than I had the last time.
We don't know what God has planned, what is planned for us. It may not be aware of the trials that we may have to go through to get there.
Yeah, good point. Good point. What's impressed you the most, this study of Genesis?
Just God's hand in everything. I mean, even with our leadership and who we voted for, it doesn't matter, God's his hand's in it. So.
Yeah, the providence passage, both comments deal with, I have seen more of those. I've seen the providence always through Genesis 37 to 50. But I saw more references to that I had missed before. I saw more of those this time. That's what impressed me the most. What's impressed you the most? Genesis. God's going to carry out his plan. God's foreknowledge of something happening and God's planning it are two different things. And God can have foreknowledge and let man have free will and then use that free will. Anything else? Yes, sir. He's got an ultimate plan. Good, good point. We're going to stop right there. Good note to end on. Exodus chapters 1 and 2 next time.